It is great to see everybody again. We are in an interesting Torah portion this week. In fact, to be honest, it's my favorite. Wait, Marilyn, did you want to say something? Go ahead, Marilyn.
As you must know, because I've said it before, this is my favorite.
Yeah, very good. Tanya said so too. Tanya said the same thing. So this is my favorite Torah portion, although it's a classic Bereishit Torah portion in the sense that too much good stuff, right? A rabbi who does not know what to say this week in the Parsha is crazy. You know, something is unbelievably wrong. It is a really interesting one. A lot of interesting things happens. So first of all, both of the stories that we read at the High Holidays, the story of Avraham casting out Hagar, the story of Avraham going up Mount Moriah with Isaac, but additionally, the story at the beginning of the Torah portion is the story of Abraham telling us that he, as we assume from the commentators, has just circumcised himself and is now sitting in the heat of the desert, and three men come across the desert who turn out to be angels, and he takes care of them and washes their feet and all that good stuff. And then the text goes on to tell us the story of Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah. So that entire, the Lot story of Sodom and Gomorrah takes place. And in addition to the Lot story in Sodom and Gomorrah, we get the story of Abraham and God bargaining over Sodom and Gomorrah. So, in short, I just listed for you five stories in the Torah that each one could be way more than one class that I could ever teach, right? We could just literally do this Torah portion all year and not even scratch the surface because there's so much material about it, which is remarkable. Last year at this time, we focused on the beginning, which was Abraham at the opening of the tent, which often teaches for the Jewish world the mitzvah of hachnasat orchim, welcoming in guests and having a big open table for you to have all sorts of random people to. In these troubled times of COVID, that is clearly not a particularly relevant mitzvah right now, right? We have these really interesting spiritual guests into our sukkah, but I don't know if any of us were actually having lots of real guests. So it's an interesting kind of idea to put on hold for this year. Because of my bent, and because of the election also a little bit, I wanted to focus on the story of Sodom and Gomorrah because it asks fundamental questions about justice. It asks fundamental questions about being outspoken, which is a Jewish tradition, as you all know. And it asks fundamental questions about, you know, morality and right and wrong. And I think that those are, even if we're not going to get into like really, you know, deeply complex issues about, you know, good versus evil and kind of a more apocryphal, like fire and brimstone. Literally, this is the Torah portion, which brings forth the phrase fire and brimstone. If we're not going to get into those issues in a kind of like a visceral, like, you know, political kind of way, but to spend a little bit more time refocusing and saying, like, what are some important, you know, baseline principles that Judaism believes about justice? Okay, with that, we'll take a look at the text. The entire text you're going to see starts off and is going to be based. So I'm doing something a little uncommon, which is I'm just giving us three lines from the Torah, and that'll be all of our texts for the day. So our three lines from the Torah, it's a little small. I can make it bigger for us all. And again, in the chat is the original text. If you didn't catch it, because I think surely you came on late, if you want to see it on your own without having to me force it down your throat with the screen share, just ask in the text. But for now, we'll just leave it as it is. So the text says in Genesis 18:22-24, it starts off, Vayifnu misham ha'anashim vayelchu stoma v'avraham odenu omed lifnei Adonai. So again, as our commentators are always going to be interested in, they're really interested in very specific words. Like, why does the Torah bother to give us an additional detail that doesn't seem to be necessary? So that translation there is, and the men went on there to Sodom, In Hebrew, we always say it as Sdom, but Americans often pronounce it as Sodom. Neither here nor there. While Abraham remained standing before the Lord, Lifnei Adonai. Okay? Second verse, or verse 23. Vayigash Avraham vayomer ha'af tispe tzadik im rasha. Avraham came forward and said, will you sweep away the innocent along with the guilty? And this is a continuing quote from Abraham. Ula yesh chamishim tzadikim batoch ha'ir ha'af tispe velo tisa lamakom laman chamishim hatzdikim asher bikir ba. What if there should be 50 innocent within the city? Will you then wipe out the place and not forgive it for the sake of the 50 innocent who are in it? So to go back to the first verse, one note says, the men went on there from Sodom. So these are the men who came to through the desert. Abraham greeted them at the front of his tent and welcomed them in. And the three men tell Abraham, you're going to have a child, right? And Sarah overhears this and laughs, right? And the child's name will eventually become Yitzchak, which means, and he laughed, or and she laughed, depending on how you understand it. When the story ends, the men have left. The men, we believe, are actually angels, because how could three men bring justice to Sodom with fire and brimstone? Rather, they are, and how could they bless Abraham with having another child? Rather, they are actually magical angels. And this is a kind of a standard Talmudic and medieval commentary on what's really going on in this story. So the story continues, and for the Sodom and Gomorrah story, if in case you don't remember the specific details, Abraham continues to bargain in tens. There is one case where he bargains in a five, but I believe overwhelmingly all the numbers are in by 10. What about 40? What if there's 30 righteous people? What if there's 20 righteous people? And he gets down to 10, and then he stops, and the story kind of moves on. And it ends with kind of Abraham making a grand statement about the importance of the righteous not being swept away with the wicked. God doesn't respond. And then a few moments later, this story pivots and it goes, and then God destroys Sodom and Gomorrah, right? Which it doesn't, God doesn't direct, it's very interesting, God doesn't directly answer Abraham. God just kind of says, Abraham has made his point. And then the story moves on, and then the city is destroyed. It's kind of like, hey, Abraham, I considered your words. Here's my answer. Boom! Right? Very interesting. We're not going to get into that. We're only focused on these three lines. And there's some really interesting stuff here. The first one is my classic bumper sticker text. It's a short line. It made me feel really good this morning. And so I commend it to you. So that first line, the men went on there to Sodom, while Abraham remained standing before the Lord. So our commentator is really interested in this little additional detail of, what is it? Omed Lifnei Adonai. So our first commentator is the Admor Rabbi Tzvi of Rimanov, who is, he wrote a book called the Be'erot HaMayim, The Wells of Water. He lived from 1778 to 1846. Rimanov is basically in modern-day Ukraine. And he said this. So in the Hebrew, it's up here at the top of the screen. But he said, it's short enough that I'll read it in Hebrew. Tamid adayin omed Avraham avinu lifnei Adonai. Lehitz palel ul hil maletz tov aleinu. And the translation of that is, it's hard to work out the words poetically enough, but I did my best. Forever does Avraham Avinu, Abraham our father, yet stand before God to pray and intercede on behalf of good for us. This is really cool. It's very Hasidic, right? The principle being, what good would it do to know that Abraham is standing 3,000 years ago? Rather, let's make it modern. And to make it modern, we say Abraham stands, present tense, before the Lord. That it's not limited idea that like once upon a time Abraham was standing in front of God. This is a principle or a kind of like Atlas rolling the rock up the hill, right? Sorry, carrying the earth on his shoulders. It's Sisyphus who rolls the rock up the hill. But Abraham's permanent status as a human being or as a divine being now that he has passed on to the next world is that he yet stands before God. Tamid, forever. Adain, yet, right? Avraham's job as a human being, as a patriarch, is to stand before the Lord to pray and to melitz, to be kind of a go-between for us and for God. I thought of this personally when I thought about the Amidah prayer, right? The first prayer we say in the Amidah, which is a prayer we say three times a day. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu v'Elohe Avoteinu Elohe Avraham, God of Abraham. So when we think about, like, why are we invoking Abraham's name three times a day, what does that do for us? I think about this quote from Tzvi Avraminov, which is to say, Abraham is the chief intercessor on our behalf. When you are feeling kerfutzed, out of sorts, anxious, nervous, not happy, and you kind of look up at the heavens and you go, I could use a break. That's Abraham. Abraham is the lead blocker on the offensive line for God. God takes that, you know, blessing that you got. You know, the Steelers are 7-0, so I have to make some sort of fakakta football analogy at some point. Abraham receives that, you know, kind of blessing that we throw up and intercedes on behalf of God and comes before the Lord our God and says, hey, God, your children down in Israel, the people Israel, the Jewish people, they're all saying the same thing. They're all struggling. Throw us a bone, man. Like, we could use some help out here. That's Abraham's role. And whether God, you know, grants us our desires and hears our blessing, the idea that Abraham is the person who stands before God and says, really? Really? Do they really deserve this? Really? And God will sometimes say, yeah. But other times God will say, you're right. You're right, Abraham. I've been too tough on them. Let's go easy this week. It's been a rough one. Let's just bring down 64 degrees and sunny in Pittsburgh today, you know? I like that idea. Okay, that's our bumper sticker text. That's just a sweet one. Our second text is probably the mind-blower and the really great one. And not shockingly, it's from one of my favorite guys who, if you've been taking this class for a while, you've seen over and over and over again. He's the guy who I turn to start translating his book. And if I ever finish the first book, this is probably going to be the second book. It's Rabbi Nosson Tzvi Finkel, The Altar of Slobodka, whose one little work is the ethical treatise known as the Or HaTzafun. He was a rabbi who lived in Israel and Hebron until 1927. He made aliyah from, it wouldn't have yet really been aliyah because there wasn't a country yet, but he came to Israel in 1922, but before that he was in Poland. Okay, he is interested in this line. Abraham came forward and said, so it's their second line in our text, Abraham came forward and said, will you sweep away the innocent along with the guilty? Okay. Interesting concept. And he's going to be very interested in, like, what this speaks about Abraham's nature. Okay. So he says this. Abraham is the foundation of chesed. So one of the Kabbalistic ideas about Abraham is he is aligned with the Kabbalistic sfirah, the 10 emanations of the divine. He is aligned with the one of chesed, loving kindness. Abraham is the foundation of chesed, loving kindness. And Sodom is against him to the greatest possible extent. Its people were the complete opposite. So what he's setting up here, the altar of Slobodka, is he's setting up the story of Abraham and Sodom and Gomorrah, not as a battle between God and Abraham, but as a battle between Abraham and Sodom. And he's actually playing it not as a literal battle so much, but as a philosophical battle, right? This is the battle of good versus evil. These are morals and values versus those that have no morals and values. And to ask the question, like, what does the conflict look like? And how does it work? And if you think this is going in a certain direction, you're probably wrong. Okay, he continues. In their wickedness and evil, they were completely working counter to everything he preached and did on their behalf. That's interesting, right? Let me finish the rest of the next sentence. They fought against it and against every positive attribute that he, Abraham, attempted to plant. And I put it at the Hebrew here, hishrish, for them. The reason I put the Hebrew there, which is, I translated the word every positive attribute that he attempted to plant for them. Hishrish is a funny word. It doesn't translate neatly. Plant is not quite right, but to translate it directly into English makes no sense whatsoever. The word hishrish is the verb to take root, or to make to take root. So that kind of works, but it better works here as plant, or like plant deeply or instill. The other reason is the word root is like about not like just putting down a tree, but in Judaism it's also about kind of the core principle, which is the same in English, the root of the matter, right? So to some degree, we're talking about Abraham trying to instill, embed, kind of like put into the ground in a really serious way, the principles of good. The interesting thing here is it's not that Abraham is fighting for on behalf of Sodom. He's also pointing out that like Abraham is good, Sodom is evil. A truly good person might say they're wicked, get rid of them. But that's not what Abraham says. Abraham says, listen, I see you guys are all doing the wrong thing. And I know that you're really wicked, so much so that you reject everything I say and everything I do. And I don't care. I'm working on your behalf anyways, right? Because the next story is Abraham goes down with Lot to Sodom and Gomorrah. And they are travelers. And the people of Sodom and Gomorrah see that Abraham has come down and stayed with Lot in his house. With two of the three visitors, one of the three angels disappears, strangely enough. Our commentators are interested in that, but I'm not going to talk about it. And the men pound on the door. This is right in the Torah. And the men pound on the door and say, we see you have a guest, a visitor. Send him out so that we may have our way with him, which is an implication of we're going to rape him. And so the interesting part of that story is we read the Altar of Slobodka's comment here into that knowledge coming forward, which is that the people of Sodom want to do bodily harm to Abraham, and yet he is working on their behalf, right? Which is kind of remarkable. You've got people out there who literally want to hurt you, and you're like fending off the police, and you're like, nope, they need to be protected. And it's a wild idea that Abraham is so righteous that he would defend people who even reject the righteousness that he is using on them. It's a crazy idea. We'll keep going, and then I'm going to open it up for your kind of questions and comments. So the text keeps going. And it could have been that Abraham would be satisfied with God's will. There, I made this word up, collapsation and destruction. But he didn't do that. Rather, he stood and he prayed for them. Because Abraham was faithful to his Torah and to his ethics, to his Musar. Would that he was contented with the downfall of Sodom. That in itself would have been characteristic of Sodom. And the core teaching of Abraham was to do good for all God's creation and not to curse them. I kind of find that mind-blowing. It's like he turns this whole text inside out in a fascinating way. Abraham had to stand up for Sodom. Why? Because the only kind of person who would stand idly by and let a whole group of people be destroyed from on high by God are the kind of people who live in Sodom, right? Righteousness is standing up against that which is unrighteous. And a person who stands idly by is just as bad as the person who is patently evil and unrighteous, right? Abraham was categorically, you know, required to do the right thing here. It's a remarkable statement, right? The only person who would stand idly by is the kind of person who deserves destruction in and of themselves, right? Had Abraham not stood up, he would have literally been as bad as the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. That's a kind of a wild idea, because I think we generally look at a lot of other characters in the Bible who stand idly by and say, oh, I'm sure there's a reason for it, right? We don't necessarily say that's wicked. Right? Being standing idly by is wickedness. But here, the Altar of Slobodka is arguing, nope, that's not okay. He would have been just as bad as the Sodomites had he stood idly by. final two lines of our text. And this is, we're really talking a lot about Abraham's core nature and why we as Jews are supposed to emulate it, right? That Abraham at his core stands up for justice and does not stand idly by, and we do not stand idly by. He continues, Abraham at his core wanted that sin should become orphaned, yatam, from like the word kaddish yatom, for those of us who know the mourner's kaddish, that wickedness should be swept away, but not the person themselves. So then he quotes the Talmud, and it's a very subtle quote, but I'll tell you the context in a second. And the quote from the Talmud that he gives is, let sins cease from the land, not sinners. So in the Hebrew, that text there is yatmu, like kaddish yatom, like make orphaned, chataim, velo chotim, right? Make sins orphans, but do not make the sinners themselves orphans. It's another way of saying, love the sin, hate the sinner. Sorry, other way around. Hate the sin, love the sinner. That's how it goes, right? You know, you should not want the destruction of wicked people. You should want them to change their ways. And he's quoting a story from the Talmud that's very, very famous. I cited it down here in really small print, but I'll read it to you, or I'll summarize it for you. The story goes like this. There were some bad men, and they came to Rabbi Meir's neighborhood, and Rabbi Meir, one of the famous rabbis of the Talmud, says, oh, these bad people, I wish they would just be obliterated like the Torah says in Psalms. And his wife, Bruria, who is the one sage woman in all of the Talmud, says, should it not be that their sins should be destroyed rather than the sinners themselves? Because does not the Torah say, da, 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 da? And he goes, you're right, honey, I'm wrong. You know, may their sins be swept away and not the sinners. And may they repent and change their ways, right? And the final line is, Rabbi Meir saw that Bruria was correct, and he prayed for God to have mercy on them, and they repented. So that's the idea that Rabbi Nosson Zvi Finkel has of our text, that Abraham has this same characteristic. He wants people to change. He wants people to be better. You know, he wants people to not, he doesn't want to destroy wicked people. He wants to change wicked people. So this is a really sympathetic read of Abraham. And basically says, like, you know, Abraham had to stand up. There was no option here. That's actually really who Abraham is. He's the guy that stands up. But he stands up because he thinks that these people can change. And this is all in the Midah, the characteristic of chesed, of loving kindness. That a person who is truly a chesedic yid, a person who believes in chesed, will say that even the worst person can change their behavior. We did a text like this months ago where I brought up the Esh Tamid, the Piasetzna Rebbe, and Kalanos Kalman Shapira of Piasetzna, who died in the Warsaw Ghetto. And a text that he wrote that I brought a long time ago to you guys was basically making the argument straight up that he didn't pray for the destruction of the Nazis, right? He wrote that in the Warsaw Ghetto while he was being, you know, kind of starved to death by the Nazis. And he said, I don't pray for the destruction of the Nazis. I pray that they change their ways. That a good chesedic Jew should pray for the change of behavior, right? I think it's really, you know, we were freaking out about the Proud Boys before this election. I think it's really hard to look at really awful human beings who threaten your very existence and say, you know, I don't wish ill upon you. It's a great act of musar to do. It's a very difficult one to say, I don't pray for your destruction. I pray that you change your behavior. I pray that you change your ways. It's one that I would say I aspire to, even if I don't always embody it. And I think that's an okay thing for me to say. And I don't know about you. I get angry just like the rest of you. And I wish destruction on wicked people just like the rest of you. But I think I remember these core teachings that if I were more like Abraham, I would not wish their destruction. I would wish for them to change. All right, with that, I'm going to let people jump in and throw in their two cents. It's a deep text. It's a good text. And the next text is going to kind of argue a little bit against it. Go ahead, Marilyn.
You know, I was going to say something. I don't think I really.
You unmuted. Yet. That's all.
Well, I was debating because I wasn't quite sure how to say it. I think that I don't know how many of you have actually read the graphic novel Watchmen, as opposed to just seeing the movie or the new version of it. But if you've read the original Alan Moore text, you know that he puts commentaries at the end of each chapter in the book, and one of the commentaries is from this section about Abraham challenging Hashem on right and wrong. And essentially, you know, it requires, as I tell my students, you have to look up the quotes and read them in context and then go back and reread the chapter and see why he's put it there. And I think that that's not the only reason this is my favorite. I have always felt, and I've said this before, that blind faith is not true faith. That faith has to be an act of will, an act of choice. And that's why I love this, because Abraham is allowed to say, that's not how I understand the teachings. I understand the teachings that we have to respect the good in the same way we might condemn the evil. And here you are saying you're going to destroy Saddam, and you haven't even looked to see if there are some good people there. And there may be. Are you going to destroy them as well? And interestingly enough, God allows Lot to leave because he finds good people as a result of Abraham being true to what he believes is right, to what is important in his faith. And in the same way, when we had our discussion about the sacrifice of Isaac, I see this as emphasizing the fact that the core of Judaism is that strong moral sense that there is right and wrong, that we can understand what it is, and that we have to strive toward it. And yes, I get very angry, but the one thing I will never allow myself to do is to wish someone dead. And I just can't do it. I can't. It goes against everything I believe I'm supposed to believe in, which was really hard when Trump got sick. But I was hoping he recovered.
Well said. I'll just add into the questions, into the chat. There was a good question from Tanya, which I can answer really quickly. She said, is Abraham a greater intercessor than Moses? Because Moses spent a lot of time asking God not to destroy them. Hold that comment for either you cheated and you went through to the next text, or hold that comment because that's the next story. So it's a really interesting one. Any other kind of questions or comments on this idea of, like, you know, being like the hate the sin, love the sinner, desire to watch people change their behavior, and how hard that is? I mean, okay. Dee, did you want to say something? No. Okay. Cool. We'll go on to the next text. The next text is really strange. It's brilliant, but it's strange because where it comes from. So I'll share that with you right now. So this is like our third text of the day. And I always, you know, it's funny that I put the who wrote it at the bottom, and then I make myself scroll to the bottom of it. I don't know why. It's just how I do things. So this text is from the Zohar. And so from those of you who know the Zohar and know this class really well, you know that the Zohar is a mystical teaching from, was put together in the 13th century. It's purportedly a second century work that was rediscovered by Rabbi Moses de Leon. The reality is probably more complicated, which is that de Leon at least wrote some of it whole cloth by himself, if not all of it, depending on which academic scholar you are following. Some people do believe that some of the Zohar is actually a mystical work composed by Shimon Bar Yochai. And then, of course, ultra-Orthodox Jews who do not believe in modern scholarship all say, well, of course, if it says it's by Shimon Bar Yochai, it's all by Shimon Bar Yochai. The dating of the material isn't necessarily important to me. It's another one of those weird things where I find all texts equally sacred and holy if they are inherently, intrinsically intellectually stimulating and spiritual, and I find them equally hot garbage on a stick if they're hot garbage on a stick and teach bad morals, right? And I don't care whether it's Torah or Chassidut, I just gave a 3,000-year window, or anything in between. Good Torah is good Torah, bad Torah is bad Torah. That's it. Now, the question of what's the difference between good Torah and bad Torah is subject to interpretation, and it's why the different streams of Judaism have so many fights to some degree, that some people think, like, this is important and that's not, and others would go another way. By the way, it's not unique to our religion. Christianity has that too. There's a reason why Episcopalians and Baptists emphasize different aspects of Christianity as the part that they think is the most important thing. All right, with that, let's take a look at the Zohar. It's a fascinating text, and Tanya sort of stole the thunder because she anticipated it. So Rabbi Elazar said, Avraham did not conduct himself appropriately and did not act with wholeness. So this is why this text is really weird, because it is, and I think that's a quote from the Talmud, but I don't know where. It's a really weird thing to say. It's really rare to see rabbis criticize Abraham. Usually Abraham is the great sage, the great patriarch, you know, Avram Avinu, our father. How, you know, we would never say anything bad. But here they say something bad. He did not conduct himself appropriately and did not act with shlemut, with wholeness. Noach did not do a thing. Okay, so shorthand, that's very shorthand for a common comparison we see by the rabbis of the Talmud and the medieval rabbis between Noah and Abraham, right? Every rabbi worth his salt has given, his or her salt, has given the sermon that Abraham is more righteous than Noah, because God said to Noah, I'm going to destroy the earth. And Noah said, cool, I'll build a boat, right? Well, God said, build a boat. But basically, I'm going to kill all these people. And Noah said, all right, if, as long as I get away with it, I'm okay. He was the only righteous bedorotav in his era. Abraham is usually held up in Judaism as much more righteous than Noah, because when God said, I'm going to destroy the city, Abraham said, wait a second, wait a second. I don't think that's a good idea. However, as you'll see in this text, or as you know, ultimately, God does destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay, so that's where this text is going to go. Abraham claimed that it should be that justice would be done appropriately, and the innocent should not be killed with the guilty. So that's a semi-quote from the Torah. He opened with 50 and continued to 10. But he did not stop, that he did not request between this one and that one not to destroy Sodom. However, who acts in wholeness and appropriately? Moses. All right, so that's Tanya, but let me go back and explain this last piece. This last piece is basically saying that Abraham starts negotiating from 50 down to 10, but he never really does the thing that, like, a lot of us who are, you know, big on justice want him to do, which is instead of negotiating down, say, like, what if there's 40 righteous people? What if there's 30 righteous people? Abraham never stops to say, is it right to just murder people? What about, going back to Nussan Svi Finkel, our previous rabbi, okay, God, they're not righteous now, but what about tomorrow? What about in a year? What about in 10 years? Is repentance possible for the people of Sodom and Gomorrah? Is mass murder the only solution? And our Torah does not say that in Abraham's name. And the Zohar is basically saying Abraham doesn't stop God when he has the chance. Abraham just kind of starts negotiating, trying to find righteous people on whose behalf we might save the city. It's a fascinating question. But then he quotes someone who does do the right thing. So he's laying out a threefold paradigm here, or three possible models of justice. The first is Noah, who we are told is righteous, but doesn't save anybody. The second is Abraham, who we are told is righteous and tries to save people, but fails. And the Zohar is condemning him for not succeeding. And the third righteous person is Moses. And we are going to call Moses the most righteous of all three because he succeeds. And we'll see that in a second. When the Kadosh Baruch Hu said to him, i.e. Moses, quote, "They have been quick to turn aside from the way that I enjoined upon them. They have made themselves a molten calf and bowed low to it and sacrificed to it, saying, 'This is your God, O Israel, whom brought you out of the land of Egypt.' Immediately it was," and that's a quote from Exodus 32, "immediately it was written, 'But Moses implored the Lord his God, saying, Let not your anger, O Lord, blaze forth against your people. And then said, Now, if you will forgive their sin, well and good. But if not, erase me from the record which you have written.' And then he refused to move from the place until God said to him, and the Lord said, 'Salachti ki dvarecha, I pardon, comma, as you have asked.'" So the Zohar does a very clever thing here. It takes one, two, three, four different Torah texts, and it deletes all the stuff that it doesn't want in the middle. Three are from the same chapter in Exodus. One is from Numbers, interestingly. And then it squeezes them all together, like they're all part of one conversation. And then uses it as the case for why Moses is the most righteous. So what's this text basically saying? The children of Israel are bowing down to the golden calf, and God comes out to Moses and says, "Yo, I'm gonna kill all these fools. They are idiots, and they do not deserve to live." And Moses replies, "God, don't be so mad at them. Calm down, settle down, and don't destroy them." Right? The implication here being, why didn't Abraham do that? That Abraham never gets down to the ground and says to God, "Come on, man, forgive them." You know, that people, human beings are stupid. They make bad choices all the time, right? Forgive them and consider that they may change if we give them enough time. Okay? So then he says, "If you forgive their sin," and this is a quote straight from Torah, which is the back end of Exodus 32. By the way, these texts in Exodus are that in chapter 32, you may not be super familiar with, because there's so much other good stuff in there. And the story of the golden calf is really complicated. And the rabbis and, you know, in our congregations, we often kind of rip through the high points and don't focus on the details. But there's this moment here, which is really important, the third verse that he brings. "Now, if you will forgive their sin, well and good. But if not, erase me from the record which you have written." God is pissed off enough with the golden calf that God is suggesting, "I'm going to destroy the entire Jewish people and make you a new people." And, right, when Noah got that story, Noah goes, "Cool with me, build me a boat," right? When Abraham gets that version, he says, find me some righteous people. I'm sure there's some righteous people. And God goes, "Nope." And Abraham goes, "Well, I guess we have to destroy them." And Moses says, "If you're going to destroy all these people, then I want you to wipe me out. Just erase all this stuff in the first 31 chapters of Exodus that you wrote about me. You know, delete me from existence and pick a new leader, because I ain't having it, right? I have no interest in this BS that you've pulled me into." And God's response to that, with a very clever reading by jumping two whole books of Torah away, but also it's a section of Torah where God is talking about forgiving the people after Moses intercedes on their behalf, although it's a slightly different story, possibly. And it says, "Vayomer Adonai salachti ki dvarecha." And the Lord said, "I pardoned as you asked," right? Moses gets down to the point where Moses says, "If you're going to kill all these people, then you better kill me too." And God says, "You're right. You're right. I pardoned the people." Now, there is one important element, I think, that is being left out of this text, and the Zohar doesn't do it. We're going to do one final paragraph, but we've hit the high notes here. There's one little piece here that's kind of left out, and that's the matter of the party that is guilty that is due to be executed, right? In Noah's story, it's all the wicked people of the earth. That's interesting. In Abraham's story, it's Sodom and Gomorrah, who are not righteous people, and also, like in the story of Noah, not Jews. And in the story of Moses, it's the Jewish people who are about to be obliterated. Now, the implication that the Zohar, I think, is making here is, that don't matter to me, right? Righteous is righteous and wicked is wicked, and your ethnic background or whether you are a Jew or not a Jew is of no concern whatsoever to me. But I think it would be unfair to ignore the fact that God forgives the Jewish people and God does not forgive two groups of non-Jewish people. I think it is worth bringing that up. That being said, I still think that the Zohar is going to kind of ignore that. And the Zohar is really interested in basically saying, which I think is, and for me, this is kind of like the, I had never seen a text like this. I had never seen a text like this that was critical of Avraham by comparison to anyone else. And I certainly didn't expect it from the Zohar, which is generally held up as a deeply spiritual kind of mystical work. Because this is a very nitty-gritty text. But I did not expect to lay Abraham out as not good enough, that he was flawed and lousy. Because I personally often hold Abraham up as the great social justice warrior of the Jewish people. Like he is this great of standing in. But the lesson we get here is be more like Moses, right? Be more like Moses, who would suffer death at God's hand sooner than witness the unfair treatment of his people. All right, we'll do the last paragraph, which is just two sentences, and then I'll let you guys comment. Because this one blew my mind, okay? Because it's related to the other one about being forgiving and being loving and wanting people to change their behavior. But it does it in a much more visceral way, and it brings quotes from the Torah to back it up, which is I found fascinating. The text finishes. Abraham saw only if there were righteous people, and if not, he did not pray on their behalf. However, there was never a person that shielded their generation like Moses, Haroeh HaNe'eman, the faithful shepherd. And I love that final line. I don't know if Marilyn's shaking her head because it's poetic or because she doesn't like it, but I think it's poetic, which is to say that Moses is just to call him Moses, the faithful shepherd. You know, I can see an entire line of children's books written about, you know, Moses, the faithful shepherd. But the idea that like you stick up for your own and you defend them to the hilt and you do not back down. And you do the righteous thing, and the righteous thing is to defend the people and hope for their change of behavior. I think that that's beautiful. All right, with that, let's open it up to everyone and see what are your reactions to this text. All right, Renee, did you want to say something? And then Renee, and then Marilyn, go ahead.
Yeah, this is it's sort of simplistic, but it reminds me. I grew up in New Jersey. We used to go into New York. And there was a sign just before, I think it was the Holland Tunnel, that says, Jesus saves. There were signs all over, but that was the big sign. And my brother, who had just started Sunday school, looks at my mother and my father and myself and says, Jesus saves, but so does Moses. I learned that in Sunday school.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I think one of the things that's important to remember about Moses in this context is this we don't often hold Moses up as the savior using the language that you use there. We often think about Moses the phrases we say about Moses in the Jewish tradition. We call him Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses our teacher. We call him Moses the lawgiver, right? The man who brought down the Torah from the mountain. We call him Moses the Redeemer, right? Moses who brought our people out from Egypt. But Savior is a different idea, and it only applies kind of if we look at the text through this story lens, which is I don't think we often think of Moses as saving the Jewish people from destruction, but our text here is making that argument. And the righteousness of an individual standing in. All right, go ahead, Marilyn.
From the pure perspective of logic, the argument is flawed in many ways. I agree with Joe. I can't believe it, but I agree with Joe again. But I think that we're reading this incorrectly in this passage, and that is that Abraham was the first. Moses was not. And I hear Abraham asking for guidance. So teach me, what is justice? not I'm only speaking to save the good. I'm asking you to tell me, should not the creator of all do what is right? Well, you tell me what is right. Is right saving everyone, you know, doing the love the sinner but not the sin? Is right just saving those who are righteous? What is right? Give me some guidance. Does it take 50 people? Does it take 10 people? And I think that that is at the core of that is not a negotiation for how many people to save. That is somebody saying, I'm trying to understand you, and you're not giving me an answer I can understand about why you want to just go in and destroy an entire city, two cities, without looking at what it is you're destroying. You're seeing only that sin, and not that there might be people there who don't agree with it. And so when you look at Moses, he's looking at a bunch of people he knows have sinned because he sees the freaking golden calf in front of him. And he doesn't need instruction. He can simply speak. And so I think that it is a flawed analogy. It is not a legitimate comparison, and it drove me nuts, but that's okay. I agree with everything Joe wrote in the comments.
I like that. I think that's a really astute observation that, like, there's a difference between the fundamental difference that I didn't mention that Marilyn brings up is that Moses observes the behavior of his people and knows them, but also hypothetically he knows that they're forgiveness they're capable of. He just knows that they might be capable of repentance. Abraham's kind of speaking out of turn in a good way, in the sense that he doesn't really know what Sodom did that's so bad. Our rabbis, by the way, in the Talmud invent a whole narrative that they think Abraham knows, and lots of stories, which are fascinating. And someday, when we have time, I will teach that entire class, which will just be weeks and weeks and weeks of the stories of Sodom and Gomorrah, because they're so good. And they basically beg the question, what is a righteous society and what is a not righteous society, which is like my favorite topic. If you would like to read a wonderful book on the subject, and it's written by a university professor, but it's not a university level read. It's called Justice in the City. It's a book by my professor in rabbinical school, Dr. Rabbi Arya Cohen. And it's pretty straightforward.
Your recommendation.
What's that?
I bought it on your recommendation.
Yeah. He has a section. It's his favorite thing to teach is the stories of Sodom, because it's really getting down to the root of, you know, what it is to be a righteous society. But Ari is a beautiful man, and I think I mentioned this last time I tried to sell his book, which is the dude's been arrested so many times I can't even count. You know, he's got a rap sheet as long as it gets. So, you know, if a rabbi is getting arrested in L.A. County, it's Ari. So if you see a rabbi on the news and it's the stories from L.A. County, you'd be like, oh, yeah, I know that guy. Okay, go ahead, Joe Jolson.
So Marilyn, I didn't realize that we disagreed very often. But having said that, for decades, I've been having this argument with other humans, some many of whom have been friends and colleagues, who judge a situation without having all the facts. Now, in this case, we weren't there with Avram. So all we have is what it says in the Torah. And I don't even have the entire passage in front of me, just a couple of sentences, which may not even run together. Suppose God suddenly appears in front of Abraham and says, I'm going to wipe out Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham doesn't have time to think about the situation. And this is the first thing that blurts out of his mouth. Or suppose God kind of implied, you know, I'm telling you this, I'm going to do it right away. And Abraham had no time to think about it. He's a human being. However, it's deeper than that. Because if you read Torah carefully, you find out that God doesn't always think about what he's doing and saying. He acts like a human being. In fact, other than having superpowers, emotionally, he or she doesn't seem to be any better balanced than a human being. What does this say about God? He even admits that he made an imperfect world for whatever the reason. So I think this is another example where we, thousands of years later, try to reconstruct what the meaning of a passage is, and we just completely overanalyze it.
I definitely can't get down.
At Lunch and Learn, I kind of said the same thing.
I can never get down with the idea of overanalyzing a passage, being that that's basically what I was invented to do. Like, that's what we rabbis do. So saying, like, but that's okay. But I think Joe makes a great point about pointing out the fallibility of God in this story and throughout the Torah, that God is angry and God is, you know, slow to, Phil says, strange book. God is slow to forgive. God makes strange choices. God makes poor choices, right? If we read God as a character in the story, rather than the way we often address God in the Torah, which is as God, as the all-powerful, all-knowing, it becomes instructive. I'll spin what Joe said one other way before I get up. I'll let you go again, Joe. But I just wanted to say one other thing, which I think is that, you know, I think one of the principles that's being presented here, either accidentally or intentionally, is the principle that justice is not an absolute, on high, knowable, you know, truth. Like, it's fairly relative, it's extremely complicated, and it's very human, right? This is one of the last instances in Torah where God kind of delivers the big punishment, you know, to the people without due course, right? Everything else from here on out has more of a system. The story of Korach, you know, there's a process for how Korach is to be judged, right or wrong. The golden calf, there's a process. Moses hitting the rock. You know, even the way the 10 plagues goes down, like, the Pharaoh's bad, and he does bad things. He's enslaved an entire nation, and he's given 10 chances to kind of set him free without any punishment, and yet that's not how it goes down. So there's like a whole justice process that starts to emerge from the Torah, but only after the story of Abraham and Sodom and Gomorrah. It's, you know, you could do a whole book on the evolution of the concept of justice throughout the Torah and how we go from the story of Noah, where we're like, that wasn't fair, to the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, where we're like, all right, it's not fair, but it's better. To finally, we're getting to, if you really wanted to go all the way through Tanakh, you know, we get our story from the book of Jonah for Yom Kippur, where we get basically the total flip of the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. All right, Joe, you wanted to say something. And then Paula.
So why are we constantly pointed out that God is so fallible and so, potentially fallible and irrational? And maybe it's so that we should better understand our own fallibilities. And perhaps this is a partial answer to Tanya's question about the destruction, the commandment to destroy the Amalekites, whatever they're Amorites.
Amalekites.
Amalekites. They're gone, so I can't remember their name. But maybe all of God's fallibilities are shoved in our face so that we will do our best not to repeat them.
Go ahead, Paula.
We have to go back to the very beginning, and God made man in his image. So he has the same fallibilities that we do to a certain extent, and it answers all of that right there.
Well, that's a good neat.
That doesn't mean we can deal with the political thing and say, well, give him a chance to have 4 more years to screw up. There's right. An exception to every rule, and this is it.
No, that's a neat solution, which is
But it answers all of that.
I think it's a neat solution. There's always going to be a little bit of lingering question about a fallible God and the notion of a fallible God and what it means for a fallible God to produce an infallible book, which is the Torah, and what that, you know, what we do with that. Now, for us modern, you know, conservative Jews, I think a lot of us are able to start to talk about the fallibility of the book, the fallibility of humans, the fallibility of God, the intent to be good, the intent to be moral, the striving to change behavior, right? And we can understand that. And yet there are the places where we can get into that are the deep, dark recesses of Jewish understanding and knowledge, where we start to debate, is this really moral? Is this truly, is this book, you know, a good enough representation? It's got behavior, a good enough representation. Are our patriarchs and matriarchs a good enough representation, you know? And so there are places like that. There are places where we go, I don't know that this is moral anymore. The two obvious examples off the top of my head for Torah are, you know, which are given by a purportedly infallible God, depending on who you ask, are the story of the Ben Sorer Umorah, the stubborn and rebellious child who we're commanded to stone to death in the gate, and the laws we have around homosexuals, which also involve stoning, right? A previous era of people in their time read the Torah and said, moral behavior is stoning to death these two individuals. And in our modern time, we say, not so much, right? That's, so it's not about fallibility. It's more about kind of change and understanding that morality and moral behavior is not black or white. If that's not the most conservative rabbi thing I've ever said in my entire life, I don't know what is. I don't know, Phil, Rana, did either of you want to say something? Okay. Marilyn, go ahead.
Listening to you would make one point, and that is that these things were written down after they happened, after the fact. There's nothing that says God took a pen and paper and wrote down the Torah. This is all past and looking at it as oral tradition and memory, which is not entirely reliable. And I think that gives us leave to sometimes question what we're told was God's behavior at a particular time, but we have no evidence that that is true or not true. And to say, to ourselves the same thing I think Abraham was doing. He's like a role model. He's modeling for us how we should live our lives. Ask questions. Think things through. Don't act blindly. And those are all the times when we look at God and say he's fallible and does horrible things, is when it appears that just arbitrarily, volatilely says, destroy everything, the whole world. I've never been fond of the Noah story, by the way. It is my least favorite in the entire Torah. I think we have to accept that the people who heard and directly received instruction from God did not write the Torah. They passed it on orally.
I think to your point, the notion of, well, the story is missing details, and if we filled in the details of the story, it would answer more questions, is either a wonderful place to sit and say, like, we're still in this realm of mystery around both Abraham and God, or it invites the writer to invent and to add, which is what the Midrash does. And I like the Midrashim around this because they go in the direction of justice. But, you know, it becomes a point for any thinking Jew to figure out, like, what is the Midrash, you know? And I've taught Midrash my whole life. And it's still in a very gray area. You know, if you're in an Orthodox home, there's a little set of books that all kids get. And it's called The Little Midrash Says. And Little Midrash Says is an illustrated set of stories that, you know, from the Midrash. But they're done in a sanitized, simplistic way, in the sense that you never would put two Midrashim in that book that contradicted one another, which means it's an edited collection, because the Midrash is full of, you know, disagreements. My favorite example of that is there are a series of Midrashim where God brings Abraham and Isaac up the mountain to slaughter Isaac, and God is telling Abraham to kill him, and the devil, Satan, is walking along with him and saying, don't do it. And there's a whole bunch of Midrashim where it's the exact same thing, But the roles are reversed. And Satan is the one telling Abraham to sacrifice his son. And God is the one who's saying, don't do it. And they can't both be right. They can't both. It's just not possible. The funny thing is the rabbis thought we were smart enough to be able to write two completely mutually exclusive midrashim and read them both and accept them both as Torah. Because that's how it's laid out. Midrash is Torah. And contradictory midrash is Torah. But for the fundamentalists amongst us, you couldn't do that. You have to sanitize it for the people because they're not smart enough to figure out these complicated things. They are smart enough, I say. Phil had a comment. To discourage undesirable newcomers, the sodomites institutionalized state cruelty so that it became a crime to feed it. Yes. Where is that quote from, Phil?
It's from the stone Chumash.
Oh, okay.
It's just like a little like thing on the side about it's probably from one of the many Sodom stories.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. So
it's really interesting because of our current political situation and various issues with them.
Right. The classic, the best midrash, which I probably told you guys before about Sodom that I really liked is there's two that are like lovely. One is that, and it's about hunger and about poverty, which we're often thinking about due to COVID. One is that when a visitor would come to town, so all the Sodom stories generally fall along the line of a new person comes to Sodom and everybody mistreats them. One of them is a new person comes to Sodom and everybody goes to them and takes a gold coin with their initials written in it and says to them, oh, welcome to town. Hey, here's a little bit of money to get you started on your feet. And they give the guy the gold coin. And then the guy goes around town and saying, can I buy some food? And no one will sell him any food. And they let it go on and on and on until he starves to death and dies. And then they go back to the middle of the street where the dead man is lying with his, you know, thing of gold coins, and everybody takes their coin back. Right? And it's a demonstration of cruelty that you would let a visitor starve to death and make them think that you were generous, which is a fascinating kind of thing, not to get political. Okay. The other one that's fascinating is a lot of the stories go along with Eliezer, who is Abraham's main servant. Eliezer goes to town and I think he walks into town and the people there see him and they say, you're a foreigner, you know, and they start throwing rocks and sticks at him and they whip him and they beat him and he's all bloodied and bashed up. And he's like, what the hell, man? So he goes to court and this is a whole nother subtrope in the Sodom stories. And in Sodom, the courts are notoriously wicked, right? Which this is the really cool thing of the Sodom stories. They basically base themselves in the principle, what if an entire judicial system was rotten to the core and a judicial system was twisted so that everything they issued was injustice, right? So they go to the judge of Sodom, and the judge of Sodom says to Eliezer, what are you here for? And he said, these people just beat me and I'm bleeding all over. And the judge goes, uh-huh. Well, then you owe each of them 40 gold coins for the medical services that were rendered to you of a good bloodletting, right? As we all know, back in the old days, bloodletting was a thing that you went to as a service. And usually these stories kind of end there because he's just been told you owe 40 golden coins for the bloodletting you were given. But that's not where this story ends. In this story, Eliezer picks up a rock and throws it at the judge and hits him in the head. And the judge starts to bleed from his head. And Eliezer looks at the judge and he says, give me the 40 coins from you since I just gave you a bloodletting and I'll give it to everybody else. And that's how the story ends. So I have no deeper wisdom on the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, but I love it. That's our class for today. I really appreciate you guys being here. Make sure you go ahead and take care of yourselves today. Do not give yourselves a bloodletting by looking too much at the news. Go ahead and enjoy the sunshine, mow your lawn, rake your leaves, and take a run. Great to see you all. If you want to stick around, you're welcome to, but otherwise, I'll see you guys next week.